says he will not tap into a contingency fund of $5 billion to keep SNAP running. This is Jill Dixon, executive director of the Food Depot, a food bank in northern New Mexico.
For every meal that a food bank provides, the SNAP program provides 9. There's no way we can replace every single one of those meals. It is not sustainable for food banks to fill this gap. We were not built to do this.
On Monday, Senator Bernie Sanders posted on social media, Trump's throwing 15 million Americans off health care. He's doubling premiums for 20 million Americans. Now he's refusing to use a $5 billion emergency SNAP fund to keep 16 million kids from going hungry. But the 1% keep $1 trillion in tax breaks. Oligarchy in action, Sanders said. We'll look more at health care in a minute. We begin in Washington, D.C. with Gina Platanino, interim director for SNAP at the Food Research and Action Center, FRAC. Thanks so much for being with us, Gina. Lay out what's happening. What is at stake this week?
At stake, it is the livelihood. It is food on the table for over 42 million of Americans who are going to lose their faith in government if the Secretary of Agriculture doesn't utilize these contingency reserves that she has in place, that she has been given the authority to utilize to ensure that SNAP benefits in November are not delayed.
And Gina, the Department of Agriculture, with Trump's appointee Brooke Rollins, put out a quite amazing statement on their website. They have in a notice to the public, quote, bottom line, the well has run dry. At this time, there will be no benefits issued November 1. We are approaching an inflection point for Senate Democrats. They can continue to hold out for health care for illegal aliens and gender mutilation procedures or reopen the government so mothers, babies, and the most vulnerable among us can receive critical nutrition assistance. Have you ever seen such a statement by a government agency?
No, and everything's incorrect. I mean, we can go down the line and breaking down every point and to just say, you know, everything's a lie. You know, we can throw out data, so much data in terms of who benefits from SNAP. 96% are U.S. citizens. Majority of people who utilize SNAP are white Americans. The people who benefit from this program are Americans. But really what it comes down to is, unfortunately, made individuals who utilize this so that they can pay for rent because they don't have enough money. Majority of people who are on SNAP are working. They live paycheck to paycheck, and this will offset them. While SNAP is supposed to be a supplemental program, in reality, it's their whole food budget. And when you have to make a decision between making sure that there's food on the table for your child while they may be getting food at school, when they come home, they're going to see mommy and daddy skipping meals. So it's just unfortunately that they're utilizing human beings, Americans, as a political battle, as a chess pieces, when they're going to have to face their landlord and say, I don't have money for food. I don't know if I can pay my rent. So we're going to see, and we're starting to see a higher utilization of credit card debt for those who still have credit cards. We're going to see, you know, more people going into the food banks, but the food banks do not have the resources and they can't make up what SNAP does, 9 meals for everyone that a food bank does. So we are going to see a decrease and people's well-being, unnecessary mental health and pressure, similarly to what we saw in the previous shutdown under the first Trump administration. But even then, the secretary appointed was able to ensure that benefits went out earlier so we wouldn't be in the situation where we are now, which is why Congress gave the authority to the secretary through contingency funds that they could utilize them. And they have been utilizing them to pay administrative expenses for the states. So they just have to tap into those resources and any additional reserves, for example, in Section 32 that they utilize to fund WIC. The secretary can and should utilize this authority and not play with people's lives, their livelihood, with their food, particularly when everything's more expensive.
And how are some states responding to this looming cutback?
Remember that SNAP is a federal program. The state handles all of the federal money. So this idea that like there are buckets of money sort of laying around, it's not correct. And states already have been trying to figure out how to come back from the reconciliation bill signed by Trump, by President Trump, in the summer, in July, because they were already trying to figure out how they were going to continue paying for SNAP, because for the first time in history, SNAP has to become a line item budget if people want to continue putting this in the program, because the reconciliation law takes away $187 billion from SNAP. So this is in continuation in terms of what the administration finds. So states were already dealing with this, saying how we're going to implement all of these changes. How are we going to do this with less administrative resources? How are we going to put money up front? And now the shutdown is happening, and people are very, you know, justifiably very angry and just upset, and don't understand that the person that can make all of this go away is the secretary, is the president, by just the secretary utilizing her power. And some states are saying, should we utilize funding? They can't do it. They don't have the resources. They are not additional reserves. And USDA sent out two memos on Friday. One of them said that states will not get reimbursed if they utilize this. So we know that Virginia's governor called it a state of emergency, and they're figuring out how to do this. We've heard from other states as well. The governor of California gave more money to food banks and mobilized the National Guard to help carry the food and make sure that they process the food. But this is a Band-Aid on a bigger issue, and it just shows the impact that the federal inaction is causing.
So finally, Gina Platanino, the children. How many children in the U.S. rely on SNAP, and what's going to happen now?
The majority of people on SNAP are children, followed by older adults, and followed by people with disabilities. You know, what's going to happen now is that these kids are going to school. Thankfully, there's child nutrition programs. They're going to get their breakfast. They're going to get their lunch, but then they're going to go home. And people forget that children don't live by themselves, right? They have a caretaker. That caretaker is already incredibly stressed out about how they're going to pay their bill and have food on the table. So, you know, the children are going to say, you know, Mommy, Daddy, why don't we have a Thanksgiving meal? Why don't we have enough food at the table? Why aren't you eating? Why do you look so stressed? And this is unnecessary burden on children to have to deal with everything else that's going on in their environment. So we're going to see an increase of mental health issues and a lower well-being for many individuals.
And your final comment on the fact that the $1 trillion tax cut for billionaires remains in place as children go hungry?
Yes. And that's what people don't understand, that this debt ceiling issue that would happen in July was a policy choice. Right. It was to extend these tax credits to incredibly wealthy individuals. It's not working class Americans. It's not middle class Americans. It is the wealthiest of wealthiest, because as all of us are struggling to pay for food that is more expensive, 3% more expensive, three times more expensive than it was last year. Billionaires are spending more money. There are various stories and research and studies to show that they have more money to spend, because this is what the tax break did. While the individuals who are working hard, because majority of people on SNAP are working, getting paid less than $1,000, these same corporations that got large tax breaks are not paying people livable wages, and so they have to rely on SNAP. And now they may not be able to pay for food, they may not be able to pay for rent, because they need to be able to eat.
Gina Platanino, I want to thank you for being with us, Interim Director for SNAP at the Food Research and Action Center, a nonprofit working to end hunger in America. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the U.S. federal government shutdown enters its 28th day, we now look at how Democrats are demanding Republicans agree to extend health care subsidies from the Affordable Care Act that are set to expire Saturday, if Republicans want the votes to end the shutdown. Health insurance premiums are expected to more than double for some 20 million people unless Congress acts. Many have already faced sticker shock when they received letters about their new premiums. The enhanced subsidies were first put in place during the pandemic. For more, we're joined here in New York by Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler, Distinguished Professor of Public Health at Hunter College CUNY, co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program, contributes regularly to top medical journals, co-authored the latest latest report just out in Lancet headlined Healthcare in the USA. Money has become the mission. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Dr. Wollhandler. Explain what you mean. Money has become the mission. Exactly what is happening, what the Republicans are refusing to do right now to reopen the government, because the Democrats are saying they won't vote for an end to the shutdown until these tax subsidies are extended.
Okay. Well, the purpose of health care has increasingly become profit-making rather than a public service. Specifically, Congress and Trump have refused to extend the tax credits, which will double the premiums for 20 million Americans who get their coverage through the Affordable Care Act. That's the line in the sand that the Democrats have drawn on the shutdown. But the bigger issues include that the one big beautiful bill that Trump signed into law on July 4th is going to cut $1 trillion out of the Medicaid program, which more than one in every five Americans rely on to make their health care affordable. Additionally, Trump has been giving giveaways to the private insurance industries, private insurance companies that have taken over the Medicare Advantage program. He doubled their pay increase this year, even though we already know that they're being overpaid by about $80 billion a year because a congressional congressional Medicare Payment Advisory Commission says they're being overpaid $80 billion. Nonetheless, Trump doubled their pay increase, meaning that prices will go up for the taxpayers and will go up for Medicare beneficiaries. So there's many things that Trump is doing, the Republican Congress is doing, to accelerate price increases and favor the for-profit provision of health care rather than thinking about health care as the public service.
And Steffi Wollhandler, these cuts will affect not just Medicaid, but also many people who are in, let's say, small business owners or the self-employed. Could you talk about that sector of the population that will be affected?
Well, many people are going to be affected by cuts in various ways, but the refusal to extend the subsidies, which is what we're talking about with the shutdown, that affects small businesses. It affects near poor people, middle income people the most. The Medicaid cuts affect everybody too. That's not just the poorest of the poor. Medicaid actually provides subsidies to many people on Medicare to reduce the price of their medications. Medicaid is a major source of funding for most rural hospitals. Many community hospitals get a big chunk of their funding from Medicaid. So when that Medicaid funding is cut, it's going to be hard for community hospitals to pay their bills, and that will affect the health care quality for everyone. So the Trump administration and Congress are cutting in many, many ways.
And you were mentioning also a Medicare Advantage. We're in this period now when literally on television, cable, social media, all of these Medicare Advantage companies are constantly, every single day advertising to seniors. It's an enormous amount of expenditure just to create more market share for each of these companies. Why do we even need to go through all of this every year?
Okay. Well, you're correct that the Medicare Advantage program is a giant waste of money. It's raised the cost to the taxpayers by $80 billion last year alone, by over $600 billion over the past 20 years or so. And yet the Trump administration is further encouraging it. It also raises costs to Medicare beneficiaries through the Part B premiums. It pushes them up. So we should have never turned over the Medicare program to these private profit-seeking insurance companies like United Healthcare. It was a giant mistake, and we should be trying to reverse that mistake now rather than encouraging it as the Trump administration is doing.
Dr. Wollhandler, put this in a global context. In the industrialized world, Where does the U.S. stand? I mean, in this country, I think people overall believe in public education. I mean, you can go to a private school if you have the money, but that everyone should be able to get an education in this country. Why does that not extend to health care? And explain how we compare to Canada, who Trump is punishing right now, to Britain. I mean, you are the co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. And how do you see us getting there from here?
Okay. Well, every other developed nation has some form of national health insurance or national health service. When we compare the United States to those other nations, we find that healthcare costs are more than 50% higher in the U.S. than they are in other nations. When we look at outcomes like life expectancy, we find that Americans live 4 years shorter than people in other countries. We're dying 4 years younger than people in Canada or France or Holland. So the national health programs have been much more effective both in guaranteeing universal access, making healthcare affordable, and also controlling costs. So we really need to be moving in that direction and away from our private, profit-oriented healthcare system.
And how do you see us getting there from here?
Well, there have been major movements for single-payer Medicare for All over time. That the issue of healthcare affordability and access is not going away. And I think that is the vision that Senator Sanders and many others have put forward about where we need to be going. And that is what we need to be doing, is keeping our eye on the prize, creating an alternative vision to what Trump is offering right now.
Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler, physician, distinguished professor of public health at Hunter College, CUNY, City University of New York, co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. We'll link to your latest report in Lancet. Healthcare in the USA, money has become the mission. Coming up, David Sirota of The Lever, a master plan, the hidden plot to legalize corruption in America. Stay with us.
It's Christmas time in Washington. Democrats rehearse, getting in gear for four more years of things not getting worse. Republicans drink whiskey neat and thank your lucky stars. They say cannot seek another term, there'll be no more FDRs. I sit home in Tennessee, staring at the screen, an uneasy feeling in my chest, wondering what it means. So come back, Woody Guthrie.
Christmas in Washington by Steve Earle here in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The right's secret plan to help billionaires buy elections. That's the headline of a recent article by our next guest, David Sirota, editor-in-chief of The Lever. In the article, David writes about how two upcoming Supreme Court cases could turn the country into what he calls a kleptocracy. The article's based on Sirota's new book, Master Plan, The Hidden Plot to Legalize Corruption in America. David also has a new piece in The Nation on the New York mayoral race, The Real Lesson from Zohran Mamdani's Ascent. David Sirota, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you start off by talking about how you define the master plan? We talked to you when you did the series of podcasts on it, The Hidden Plot to Legalize Corruption in America.
So we're immersed in corruption. You see it in the headlines every day. And I think there's this perception that this is a natural course of events in the sense of it's a force of nature. But what we unearth in the book, for the first time really ever, is the secret plan to make this kind of corruption that we're immersed in legal? A plan hatched in the early 1970s to begin deregulating the campaign finance system and narrowing and making essentially unenforceable the anti-bribery laws in America. It started with the Powell memo. There was a lot of organizing. This memo written by a soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell, who urged a corporate investment and an oligarch investment in politics and media, because he was afraid, and corporate America was afraid, of the rising tide of consumer protection laws and the like. And that out of that movement in the early 1970s came the movement to create court rulings and legal precedents equating money in politics not with corruption, but with constitutionally protected speech, giving corporations those constitutional rights to spend and in elections and buy elections, ultimately culminating in Citizens United. Meanwhile, a series of court rulings starting in the mid-2010s to overturn corruption convictions, to narrow the definition of bribery, leading up to now, as you alluded to in the intro, two cases at the Supreme Court, one spearheaded by Vice President J.D. Vance, to eliminate what was left of campaign finance restrictions after Citizens United, and to further reduce the definition of bribery to make essentially quid pro quo transactions in politics legal. This is all part of a plan by a corporate movement that sees democracy, the government providing what people want, sees that as a threat and wants to turn the democracy from a one vote kind of democracy into a $1 kind of democracy where money is the decider.
But David, why do you call it a secret plan if it's basically a class or a group of people within a class clearly operating in their own interests?
That's certainly true. What we uncover in the book is from the Powell memo, this memo written by Lewis Powell, came never before revealed a series of meetings and task forces by the country's most powerful people. We're talking about executives at major media companies and Fortune 500 companies forming a task force to implement the Powell memo's demands that corporations invest in and essentially take over American politics. What you saw in the 1970s into the 80s and 90s was the implementation of what the Powell memo had called for. And it was not revealed. It was all, much of it was done in secret. We're talking about investments in motion pictures. We're talking about investments in media entities. We're talking about strategizing for how to implement and put loopholes into campaign finance laws. One of the first meetings that came out of the Powell memo, let me give you one example, was a meeting at Disney World, where they flew in Gerald Ford, who was soon to be the president, at a time when anti-corruption laws were moving through Congress after Watergate, and they ended up slipping in a loophole into that original campaign finance bill, which created the corporate PAC for the first time. And of course, from there, we get the rulings that I've just mentioned.
You also talk about the Mamdani campaign and a lot of the political pundits ascribing his success to his messaging and charisma. But you raise also the issue of how a public financing of elections has made Mamdani's success possible as well.
Yeah, to my mind, having worked on campaigns and having reported on political campaign finance, there's this debate, right? Did Zoran Mamdani ascend because of his charisma, his slick ads, his message? I think all of those were factors. But I don't think there really would be a Zoran Mamdani campaign without New York City's system of publicly financed campaigns, a system that offers candidates like Zoran Mamdani, any qualifying candidates, matching funds, public matching funds for their small donations. So we've seen a lot of oligarch money flow into the New York City mayor's race. The reason Mamdani has been able to run a well-resourced campaign is because of that public financing system, which gives a candidate like him access to resources that don't come with the demands of legislative favors. They are not private money donations that come from donors who want things from City Hall. So Mamdani, that system has given Mamdani enough money not to outspend his opponents, but to at least run a competitive campaign. And so I think people looking at that race, wondering what the takeaways are for democracy, how can we have more outside the system candidates who can stand up to billionaires and oligarchs and the like, they should be looking at New York City's public financing system as a replicable model in other cities and other states across the country.
If you can talk, David Sirota, about all the latest news, for example, the pardons of the Binance CEO and what this means for the Trump family. You have President Trump last Thursday pardoning the convicted founder of the cryptocurrency exchange Binance, Changpeng Zhao. He pleaded guilty in 2023 to enabling money laundering while he was CEO of Binance. According to the Wall Street Journal, Binance struck a business deal with World Liberty Financial, the Trump family crypto startup, which has generated $4.5 billion since Trump returned to office. And then there's a major Reuters expose, the U.S. president's family raking in more than $800 million from sales of crypto assets in the first half of this year alone. If you can explain how that fits into your description of a master plan.
For sure. I mean, this is really the culmination of it. Starting in the mid-2010s, there was a series of rulings. This is, if people remember, the Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell corruption case, where he was convicted and the Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, intervened to overturn that conviction. That became the Chris Christie AIDS case, the Andrew Cuomo AIDS case, a bunch of corruption convictions that were overturned, culminating in last year's decision where an Indiana mayor was convicted on corruption for delivering a government contract and then getting a payment from the contractor afterwards. That conviction corruption was overturned. The court said that it wasn't bribery, it was a gratuity. So Trump is operating in a legal environment that has so narrowed down the definition of corruption to make it almost unprosecutable and unenforceable. So I think when we look at stories of Donald Trump, his business dealings in enriching himself through his position as president, we have to understand that they are knowingly operating inside of a legal environment that has made it almost impossible to prosecute bribery. And that was part of the plan to deregulate the campaign finance system and to reduce those bribery laws. Because reducing those bribery laws and deregulating the campaign finance system essentially reduces the power of people. It rigs the democracy. How can Trump be held accountable if the highest court in the land essentially says that bribery is no longer a crime?
David, could you talk about the intimidation and the changes in ownership in the major media companies to basically bring them under heel to this authoritarian government we have now?
I'm so glad you asked this. One of the things that we uncovered that was kind of, in a sense, shocking to me because it was so explicit. Back when Lewis Powell wrote his memo in the early 1970s, and there were these task forces about implementing the Powell memo, some of the top executives at the largest media companies in the country participated in that endeavor to implement the Powell memo. We unearthed a letter from CBS's president at the time saying not only did he agree with the Powell memo's directives and ideology, but that he was working to correct the situation at CBS News. That's a direct quote. And so I think we have to look at what's gone on with media consolidation.
We have 30 seconds, David.
With Donald Trump essentially saying media mergers are predicated on his political ideology, we have to look at that as the culmination of the government trying to pressure and successfully pressuring media companies to do its bidding.
We want to thank you so much, David, for being with us. David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever, speaking to us from Denver, Colorado, co-author of Master Plan, The Hidden Plot to Legalize Corruption in America. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamarie A. Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are now listening to CJSS 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.